Good morning, Your Honors. Tim Scott for the appellant, Luis Bautista. I'd like to start this morning with the question of the withdrawal of the plea and whether there was a fair and just reason to do so under this court's precedent. Legally, this is not supposed to be a particularly high hurdle for a moving party to overcome, particularly when the motion is made post-plea but pre-sentencing. Our case law describes it as a generous standard to be applied liberally. And this is true even if the Rule 11 colloquy is otherwise perfectly valid. Now, factually, there's no dispute, as I understand it, that the government withheld certain facts until after Mr. Bautista pled guilty. And so there were concrete things that he could point to as either newly discovered evidence or a change in circumstance that he cited as motivating his motion to withdraw the plea. Specifically, the revelation that it was his then-wife who was the genesis of the government's investigation, who had first reported him to the FBI and worked throughout the course of an entire summer, it seems, to gather evidence against him, and then was later compensated to the tune of $8,000 after Mr. Bautista went to jail. Those were important facts, and I don't think it's overstating it to say that any criminal defendant would want to know those facts, would want to know that it was their own spouse who was building the case for the government before making the decision to plead guilty.
Now, Mr. Scott, the government's going to stand up and say, well, that's not the standard we should apply today because there was a plea agreement in this case, and your client waive the right to appeal. Why aren't they right on that?
Well, there's three reasons why this withdrawal of the plea issue isn't barred by the plea agreement. The first is that at the end of the sentencing, Judge Guilford told Mr. Bautista, if you wish to appeal, you must do so within 14 days. That wasn't ambiguous where he said, you may have the right to appeal, or I don't know if you have the right to appeal. He said, if you wish to appeal, do so in 14 days. I think that fits within our case law, which says that if the trial court indicates to the defendant that they do have the right to appeal, then the defendant can fairly rely upon that. The second reason, beyond being advised by Judge Guilford, is that even if we do apply the plea agreement, there is still the question of voluntariness. And that's a little bit of a term of art in the context of pleading guilty. It needs to be a voluntary and intelligent decision made among the available options.
Did he have a right to know that his wife had been informing on him?
If he had a right to know under discovery, I think we could probably debate both sides about whether there was either a Rule 16 right at that point or a Brady right. Maybe not to be evasive, but the reason...
I wonder about the whole marital privilege and whether he could have, asserted that or...
Well, it's certainly one of the reasons that he moved to withdraw the plea. And what I was winding up to, I didn't mean to sidestep the court's question, is that whether or not he had an absolute right to that information, the question really is the revelation of that information a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea? Or is it a plausible basis for him to want to make that decision? And so, setting aside whether the government should have turned it over earlier or should not have, I don't think we necessarily need to answer that question because the fact is this is a plausible reason for him to want to withdraw the plea in a fair and just basis for doing so. The third reason in terms of why the plea is not waived, there was the advisal by Judge Guilford, the voluntariness. It's simply not a voluntary and an intelligent waiver of the right to appeal if he hasn't been apprised of all his options. He was deprived of key information and had unequal bargaining information in entering into that plea agreement.
But I think the old Ninth Circuit case law might agree with you, but after Ruiz in the Supreme Court, it seems you've got to explain why Ruiz doesn't shut you down on that.
Well, I guess the third reason even behind that would be that we've also framed this as a breach of the government's duty of good faith and fair dealing. And so Mr. Bautista, in our view, reasonably felt somewhat like the victim of a bait and switch, wherein he pled guilty to a fairly benign factual basis that gave rise to guidelines of 6 to 12 months. And after revealing this information from the ex-wife, the government sought a 12-level enhancement. Now, granted, the government could argue outside the guideline range and could ask for upward adjustments. That was in the plea agreement. But 12 levels and analogizing those levels to attempted murder is simply so far beyond the expectation of Mr. Baptista that I think it's tantamount to sharp practice and doesn't comport well with the government's duty of good faith and fair dealing.
Now, counsel, I could see your argument as to counts 2 and 4 because those were after the contact with the wife. But counts 1 and 3, as alleged in the indictment to which your client pled, were before any contact with the wife. So I understand the argument for counts 2 and 4, but for counts 1 and 3, how do we undermine counts 1 and 3 when the activity was before the wife ever contacted the FBI?
Well, I guess there's a factual answer and a legal answer. Factually, that's the way the record sits right now because that's the way that the government gave us the information afterwards. What Mr. Baptista wanted to do was to take investigation, take discovery, and start building the factual record to find out satisfactorily through cross-examination, through the government's Rule 16 obligations, once we're asking for the right things. We suspect that we might have been able to change that timeline. So I'm not comfortable saying that the government's version of events is etched in stone because it's simply what the government chose to give us at the last moment. So we think that we would have been able to change that factual record substantially had we been given the opportunity to do so. But legally, it's still a matter of bargaining power and of the deal that he struck. If he had a bulletproof defense or even a plausible defense, which is the test, to the latter two counts, to counts 2 and 4, that may have changed the calculus of whether he would have accepted a plea to the other one. If he had that bargaining power, he would have been able to drive a better bargain and wouldn't necessarily have had to plead to those things, or at least could have asked the government to give him better concessions on those particular facets of his plea. The error that, in our view, Judge Guilford made was similar to the errors that were made in McTiernan and in Garcia. The record reflects that Judge Guilford put a great deal of stock in the fact that Mr. Baptista, according to the judge, was taking a position that was contrary to what he said in open court and under oath. And the court several different times italicized open court and under oath in its order denying his motion. And I would respectfully submit that that's simply a misunderstanding of Mr. Baptista's position and of the governing law. Mr. Baptista wasn't trying to undermine the thoroughness of the Rule 11 colloquy or disparage Judge Guilford in the care in which he took the plea. He was simply saying, I know something now that I didn't know then. And had I known then what I know now, I wouldn't have entered the plea. So the thoroughness of the Rule 11 colloquy and the penetrating care that Judge Guilford took, as he described in his order, is simply entirely beside the point. And more than being beside the point, it was legal error, we would suggest, for the court to hang its hat on that. It was equally legal error for the court to get into a kind of a fine gauge evaluation of the merits. It at least approached a factual finding about whether the ex-wife was an agent of the government. I'm not sure he went so far as to say it's a factual finding, but he at least suggested that Mr. Baptista would have trouble with that. The merits are not the issue. They weren't the issue on the Title III wiretap in the McTiernan case, and they weren't the issue on the St. Cyr issue in the Ortega case. The question is not whether Baptista would win. It's not whether they were meritorious and would have carried the day. It's not whether there was even good arguments on the other side. The question was, is it simply a plausible reason that at least would have plausibly motivated him to reconsider and to do something different than the decision that he made? So with that, I'll try to reserve a minute for rebuttal. Thank you so much, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Scott Tenley for the United States. I want to start with the waiver issue that we began with, and I would note the advisement from Judge Guilford is virtually identical to an advisement this Court considered in 2015 in a case called United States versus Basulto. Now, that's a memorandum decision, but the Court looked at an advisement of appeal that said, if you wish to appeal this sentence, it has to be done within 14 days. And that did not vitiate the appellate waiver. And also important in that case was the fact that there was no statement that the defendant had a right to appeal, which we see in the other cases like Buchanan and Felix. So I don't think the appellate waiver is waived. With respect to voluntariness, this has always been a question at the district court and in the briefs about whether the defendant had a fair and just reason. He never raised the question of voluntariness until the government raised the appellate waiver. And the issue of voluntariness is whether the defendant knew everything about his options or whether he was coerced under duress or had a promise made to him that wasn't fulfilled. None of those happened here. And I think Your Honor is right. In Ruiz, the Supreme Court made clear that the defendant doesn't have to have every possible fact available to him. He just needs to make a reasonable choice among his options. So on that basis, I do believe the appeal on the motion is waived.
Do you have a case that's comparable to this? I mean, it seems to me this is a rather unusual case where he finds out later that his wife, who he had been trusting with all the details of what his plans were down in Brazil, had been talking to the FBI all along. Do we have a case that's anywhere close to this?
Not that I can cite to you, Your Honor, but I think I want to draw as a factual distinction here. In discovery, we produced statements that the wife made to the FBI when they executed a search warrant. And in that report, she laid out the defendant's entire plan, what he was going to use the items for and what he intended to do.
Was that pre-entry of the plea agreement?
Yes. That was before the entry of the plea agreement. After the plea agreement, we produced two facts that were new. One is that she was the original tipster, and then the relocation payment that was made 2 months after she made the tip. So not only did we produce in discovery her statements and the theory of the case, but we also argued and litigated that theory in response to the defendant's necessity motion. So this isn't a case where the defendant was blindsided by this theory that came out of the blue. He knew that was the government's theory, and he also knew in the plea agreement he didn't have protections to limit his sentence. So there was no breach of good faith or fair dealing in that regard. With respect to the marital privilege that you raised, Your Honor, we've cited the cases in the brief. The government is allowed to use statements of a spouse to investigate and apprehend a suspect and to obtain a search warrant. So while there are marital privilege kind of issues floating around the case, on the front end, there would be no relief for the defendant. We still could have investigated, prosecuted, and executed the search warrants on the basis of those statements.
So you're saying that it wasn't a surprise to the defendant that the government sought such a substantial enhancement based on the conduct that wasn't charged?
He certainly had no notice of what the requested sentence would be. That was a decision we made and put in our papers. But during the necessity litigation, not only did we brief our theory, but there was discussion about the fact that there's case law from the circuit that says motive in a passport fraud case can be a grounds for an upward departure. And I discussed that briefly, very briefly, with Judge Guilford in the hearing. So there certainly was a sense from the government that was communicated in those hearings that this wasn't a typical passport fraud case, that the fact that this was going to be used to commit murder in a foreign country was something that we thought was very serious and dangerous. On the one last thing, and then I'll move on, is the issue of the tipster and the relocation payment only applies to counts 2 and 4. Counts 1 and 3, as Judge Owens pointed out, were committed on June 3rd, 2015. It wasn't until 6 weeks later that Ms. Christensen first came in and reported the defendant's conduct. Now, Mr. Scott's point was that potentially there's more discovery on that issue, but I'd refer the court to page 146 of the record. It's a walk-in complaint from the defendant's wife at the FBI. It's documented that that's how we learned about it. And so I think it's pure speculation that there's anything prior that would have changed the view on counts 1 and 3.
Is that why ER 146 is not a 302?
Correct.
Okay, I was wondering
that's
why that was the case.
That's how they document the complaints. Now, the report we produced in connection with the search warrant that laid out what she said, that was a 302, Your Honor. With respect to the necessity issue, I think the most glaring deficiency here is the legal alternatives issue. The defendant can not commit a crime when he has a lot of other choices available to him. And here, the most obvious one is to call the Brazilian police. And he didn't want to do that because he thought the children would end up in a group home and that every group home in Brazil is run by pedophiles. That's his subjective view, but the question is, what would a reasonably objective jury say there? And because that avenue is available to him, it was unreasonable for him to say, I can't avail myself of it.
And as I understand your argument, he also could have just traveled to Brazil on his Brazilian passport. He just didn't want to because of potential immigration consequences here.
That's right. Now, his passport expired on May 3rd, so he had that legal avenue to travel up through May 3rd. After that, he could have abandoned his U.S. citizenship application and traveled. There was nothing keeping him in. He wasn't in custody. He had options to go down himself. On top of that, he had the United States State Department that could have performed a welfare and whereabouts visit, and he was involved in Hague Convention proceedings. He was kind of obviously and reasonably frustrated and impatient, but that doesn't give him the ability to violate federal law in that regard. In addition to the alternatives, the only other one prong that I touch on is the imminent harm. And certainly when you have your children in danger, that is understandable, that any father is going to be upset. But the proffer here was insufficient for Judge Guilford to find that element was met, because all we have is things about emails about tantrums, emails about arguments, and then an unspecified plan that the wife, the children's mother, might move them to Europe. And so it's not that immediate emergency that would cause the defendant to have an excuse for violating federal law. One of the examples we see in the case law is, can a prisoner escape a prison if it's on fire? And the answer is yes, because that is an imminent, immediate threat to his health and safety. But here there were a number of other options, and there were also there wasn't an immediate harm that he had to justify by violating the law. So on that basis, unless the court has questions, I'll submit.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. A couple quick points. Mr. Baptista absolutely was blindsided by this revelation. The government's suggestion in the prior litigation about the wife's testimony was contradicted by her own statements that she was making to him simultaneously. She was apparently playing both sides and telling him one thing in the jail and telling him that the FBI was pressuring her and that, you know, would you please plead guilty? And because he was missing the key information about her compensation and the fact that she was the original tipster, he believed her, and he simply didn't put stock in what the government disclosed without telling the entire story, that she was the tipster and that she was on the payroll. So he didn't have that expectation. He believed his wife at the time that she was talking to him while still working with the government. That was the key problem and the key missing information. This isn't a question of knowing all the facts, like the Ruiz case. This is a question of having a reasonable opportunity to weigh the available options. And it's not a knowing decision among options.
Have been the options? Like what changed once he found out the identity of the informant?
Well, the options would have been pursuing an entrapment defense, whether just on the last two counts or whether on all of them, depending on how far the timeline would have reached back in terms of the cooperation. It would have been potentially an outrageous government conduct motion, particularly when coupled with what we felt was a Messiah violation for having her continue to meet with him and report back to the government while he was in custody. It also gave rise to a Frank's challenge to the search warrant, to other motions practiced, including marital privilege that he would have wanted to raise. So he would have wanted to at least explore those things. Again, would they have carried the day? Perhaps, but he had the right to explore them and to decide whether or not he wanted to do that rather than the plea that he took. And finally, I know I'm over, but in terms of the waiver, the government cited an unpublished opinion about this language. If you wish to appeal, you must do so within 14 days. I would suggest that if a person said to another person, if you wish to have lunch, please let me know by 11, that person would think they're invited to lunch. And if they let them know by 11 and the person said, oh, sorry, I never invited you to lunch, that would just not comport with kind of normal language and a person's reasonable expectations. So I don't think there's a waiver here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. U.S. v. Baptista will be submitted.